From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. He hasn't committed a classic crime of war. He hasn't fired a single shot against American troops. But U.S. citizen Jose Padilla, also known by his Islamic convert name Abdullah al-Muhajir, is being held indefinitely and incommunicado in a U.S. Navy brig in South Carolina. Attorney General John Ashcroft slapped the label of enemy combatant on Padilla, and in so doing, he also slapped away this American's civil liberties. The U.S. government says al-Muhajir was plotting to kill Americans with a dirty bomb sometime in the future, and in the global war on terror, intent is as bad as action when it comes to threats against America. Padilla is now off the streets and where he needs to be, President Bush said today. But where he's ended up, in a military prison and without his day in court, has sparked a national debate over real and present dangers and the sanctity of civil liberties in the war on terror. This hour, citizenship, civil rights, and the case of Jose Padilla. We begin tonight with a look at the man who helped lead authorities to Jose Padilla. Captured in March, Abu Zubaydah is the highest-ranking al-Qaeda member currently in U.S. custody. Government officials say Zubaydah provided key information on plans to make a dirty bomb. Earlier, I spoke with Philip Sheenan, reporter for The New York Times. I asked him how much information about recent terror warnings has been linked back to Zubaydah.
Apparently an awful lot of the terrorism alerts that we've experienced the last couple of months come from small tidbits often that Abu Zubaydah has related during the course of these interrogations he's been undergoing since March.
That would include then the Brooklyn Bridge warning, the Statue of Liberty warning, the warning of a potential threat to banks, all of these back to Zubaydah?
Apparently so. Apartment complexes, it was Zubaydah who apparently first disclosed the plans about the potential dirty bomb that might be detonated someplace in the United States. He's been responsible for a tremendous amount. I think he is the root cause of an awful lot of these alerts.
And what is the link, if any, between Abu Zubaydah and Jose Padilla, also known as Abdullah al-Muhajir, the American who's now in custody? The administration has said he was coming to the States to do reconnaissance to unleash a dirty bomb, perhaps on Washington, D.C. Is there a link?
Some government officials describe Padilla as a protege of Zubaydah, that sometime late last year, Padilla found his way to Zubaydah's lair in Afghanistan and volunteered his services and was then tasked by Zubaydah to go gather training on radioactivity and on the potential manufacture of dirty bombs and other sorts of weapons.
How important was Abu Zubaydah in Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda organization, and what exactly was his role?
Most recently, he had been apparently the chief of operations for al-Qaeda. He was responsible for a number of years for the recruiting of students who went into al-Qaeda's training camps in Afghanistan. I've seen him described as the number three official within al-Qaeda in recent months.
So it's possible that he would have been the person who met with Jose Padilla and decided that it was worth taking him on into the fold of al-Qaeda.
Not only did he meet with him, the story told by the administration is that Zubaydah and Padilla actually traveled together in Pakistan, a place that Zubaydah knows well because he made his base in Pakistan for a good number of years.
So when and how did this very high-ranking al-Qaeda official come into American hands? Under what circumstances?
He is believed to have fled Afghanistan sometime late last year in the wake of the American assault on Afghanistan, made his way to Pakistan, again, a place he knows how to operate in. He was captured in a shootout in the northern Pakistani city of Faisalabad with a number of associates in March. Apparently, he suffered rather serious wounds during that shootout, was taken into custody by the Pakistanis, was handed over quickly to the United States, was hospitalized for a period of time at a Pakistani airbase, and was then moved out of Pakistan to some other overseas location that we do not know the identity of.
So he's being treated like solid gold by FBI and CIA interrogators.
It appears that his capture was the single most important development in the war on terrorism from the American standpoint.
There's a lot of attention being paid now to how the American Jose Padilla is being held and perhaps interrogated. What do we know about how and where Abu Zubaydah is being held? And more specifically, how is his interrogation being handled? Is he a cooperative witness? How are they going about it?
He is not cooperative. In fact, we're told that he remains quite defiant, making statements of his continued loyalty to al-Qaeda, sometimes taunting his interrogators. What happens, apparently, is that in the course of his boasting, he will sometimes divulge a name, a location, a date. And from that information, the American authorities then cross-check it with the information that's been gathered from the interrogations of other al-Qaeda people in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay, and with the documentary materials that were seized from caves in Afghanistan. And when they've cross-checked that information, they've been able to find information that checks out from several sources, allowing them to go forward with the terrorism alerts and to go forward with additional arrests.
So is this what John Ashcroft may be referring to when he says they have solid corroborating evidence that supports their allegation of Padilla being intent on some kind of dirty bomb mission?
Apparently so, though I will say that from what we've learned in the last 24 hours, it appears that the Justice Department may have overstated some of the evidence against Padilla, at least as regards to this dirty bomb and how seriously Padilla had been involved in the preparation for the manufacture of such a weapon.
What do we know about Abu Zubaydah's background?
He is in his early 30s. He is a Saudi-born Palestinian. He is interesting for many reasons, not the least of which is that he's the only Palestinian at the senior ranks of al-Qaeda. We don't know quite how he made his way to Afghanistan, but at some point he did, and came quickly under the wing of bin Laden, who was impressed by his intelligence, his linguistic skills, and his ability to hide himself. He apparently has as many as 40 aliases.
And who exactly is interrogating him wherever he is in the world now? Who's doing it, and what do we know about the range of techniques that they're using to try and pull information out of this al-Qaeda boss?
We know it's a team of CIA and FBI interrogators, men and women who have an expertise in obtaining information from reluctant or hostile witnesses. These are people who trained apparently in a variety of techniques, various forms of sort of psychological warfare, gamesmanship that involve at times praising the witness, at other times threatening to the witness. We are receiving repeated statements from the administration that there is no torture involved here, no physical torture.
But psychological manipulation?
One has to wonder if there's some sort of psychological manipulation, psychological torture going on, or at least the threat that down the road he could face something far more unpleasant.
Philip Sheehan, from what you've seen and learned about the story of Abu Zubaydah, what does it tell us about the effectiveness of U.S. interrogation and, I guess, the broader investigation of al-Qaeda to this point?
Well, if the story being told by the administration is true, it's probably good news that on the basis of just bits and pieces of information provided from a hostile witness, they've been able to act on arrests, they've been able to possibly even preempt additional terrorist attacks. Though I think there is an interesting question here raised by some of my colleagues, which is that apparently, certainly in the last year, all it would have taken was an American passport to get you into the inner circles of al-Qaeda. So why was it so difficult for the CIA to penetrate this group over so many years?
Philip Sheehan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Philip Sheehan is a reporter for the New York Times. He spoke with us from Washington, D.C. We're talking tonight about civil liberties and the war on terror. Should the U.S. Constitution take a back seat to national security? Does it need to? Are you concerned that a U.S. citizen is being held without charges or trial? Or have the rules changed with the war on terror? And do you trust the government to make the right call when civil liberties apply? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us this evening is Lawrence Tribe. He's professor of constitutional law at Harvard University. Good evening and welcome back, Lawrence Tribe.
Good evening, Tom.
It's good to have you. Also with us tonight from our Providence studios is On Point news analyst Lewis Gordon, director of Africana Studies at Brown University. Hello, Lewis.
Good evening, Tom.
Lawrence Tribe, the stakes seem so enormously high here, both for civil liberties and for real national security reasons. We want to talk about this in detail tonight because it's too easy to gloss over any aspect of this, but give us your top-level view first. Is the U.S. government acting within the scope of the Constitution and precedent in the way that it is holding Jose Padilla?
Well, if it is genuinely holding him incommunicado, and if it is preventing him from having any access to his court-appointed attorney, someone I understand who has filed a petition for a writ of habeas corpus, and if it's expecting us simply to accept its say-so, that this gentleman is genuinely an active member of al-Qaeda, that al-Muhajir joined up with the enemy force. If it's doing all of that, then it is clearly violating the Constitution. But I think it's too early to say how the administration is going to respond when the federal court receives its answer. The government has been ordered by June 21st to respond to the petition for habeas corpus, the classic time-honored way of challenging the legality of someone's detention by the government. There will be some procedural maneuvers, I imagine, because there's an argument that the petition really should not have been filed in New York, but it should have been filed in South Carolina, where he's being held in a naval brig. But when push comes to shove, in the end, the government is going to have to present, perhaps in a closed proceeding if necessary, some objective basis for believing, beyond the president's say-so, that this is a bad guy.
What will force the government to present that evidence or that case, Lawrence Tribe?
Well, the court, if it takes the rule of law seriously, will say that in the absence of some objective basis to believe that this United States citizen, who was apprehended in Chicago after he flew from Pakistan through Switzerland, is really a member of an enemy force, absent objective proof, I order you to release him. And at that point, unless the government defies such an order, it will produce some objective basis for believing that he is on more than simply a presidential enemies list, that he is indeed a member of the enemy against whom Congress specifically authorized the president to wage military combat in its resolution a week after the atrocities of 9/11. If a court backs off and if a lower court accepts the unilateral assertion of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld that because we say he is an enemy combatant, you have to take our word for it, more or less as they have said of the detainees in Camp X-Ray in Guantanamo, claiming that because they assert that these are unlawful combatants, no one can question it, then a higher court is going to have to direct the government to do better than that. And if the United States Supreme Court backs off, then I think we are in completely uncharted territory, because I think none of us wants to live, even in the name of security, under a regime where, under any president's say-so, any citizen can be whisked off the street, disappeared in effect, on the mere claim that some affiliation with this or that terrorist group has made him or her an enemy of the state.
Lawrence Tribe, you're one of the country's leading constitutional law scholars. You follow the court, the Supreme Court, and the courts closely. At this point, do you have any reason to think that the courts will not stand up and do what you describe the Constitution as requiring?
Well, the courts have not always been so courageous during the period of combat. We all, I think, know, even though most of us are not old enough to remember, the detention of 70 to 80,000 Americans of Japanese descent after Pearl Harbor, and the United States Supreme Court in the now infamous decision of Korematsu versus the United States held that their exclusion from the West Coast was impermissible. But in a little-known companion decision involving a woman named Mitsuya Endo, the Supreme Court quite quietly held that the detention of these American citizens of Japanese descent when they were loyal was a violation of law. They didn't necessarily say it was unconstitutional, but they said there was no congressional authorization for it. Any more than, by the way, there is any congressional authorization for the whole system of military tribunals that has been set up.
Lawrence Tribe, we've got to take a short break. We're going to come back and dig into this step by step. We really want to understand these issues. We're talking about civil liberties and the war on terror, the case of Jose Padilla and beyond. What are the civil liberties issues that the war on terror has thrown on the table here? And what do you think when you see an American citizen held incommunicado without charge indefinitely? Does the war on terror require it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about civil liberties and the war on terrorism. The case of Jose Padilla, also known as Abdullah al-Muhajir, his Islamic convert name, that case and beyond. Our guest tonight is Lawrence Tribe. He's professor of constitutional law at Harvard Law School, one of the country's leading constitutional law scholars. And the question for you is, how much are you prepared to let liberties slide in the interest of security? Is the United States government striking the right balance of security and civil liberties? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to turn to our guest news analyst tonight, Lewis Gordon. Lewis Gordon, this is a very difficult conversation and even issue to think through when you've seen those towers collapse in New York, when you've seen the suffering that that caused, when we're told day after day of the scale of mass destruction that could be visited upon this country by terrorists. It is not easy in those extreme circumstances to balance civil liberties and a dire national security issue.
Indeed, we see it brewing toward the classic conflict of two divisions of government. Some of the problems we're having are also a function of the incoherence of the expression of war on terror. When it was a matter of going to get the Taliban, going into Afghanistan, it met a lot of at least some of the features of war of one nation against a nation. But when we're talking about Al-Qaeda, we're talking about something that seems almost like a floating nation. And it seems as if the question of a war here is almost taking the form of a metaphor. And I bring this up mainly because, you see, if we're talking about the classic case of a POW, the POW is caught on the battlefield. You know, the evidence is there that the person is engaged in the war. Mm-hmm. But when we're talking about people who are accused, there is a fact-finding problem that's at work through which one can determine exactly what they have done and how one can follow other procedures to get information from there. Now, in many ways, this means that questions of evidence, questions of procedure, questions that really come through trying to find out, for instance, if individuals are even guilty, have been suspended. And in this context, it seems to be that the category terrorism, so to speak, seems to be creating a new or unique class of crimes with which to deal. There's one more thing that I want to add to that. The structure of the way Padilla is being pursued is looking more and more like what's going on in an international criminal pursuit than a war on terror. And this is something that, again, will bring in more of some of the civil liberties issues at hand.
Well, you're really getting to the heart of it. Lawrence Tribe, come in with us here. If you would, give us the basics of what extraordinary steps or measures the Constitution and precedent do provide for in wartime, and then fast forward that to this war and talk with us about how those precedents apply.
Well, let me actually begin a little bit with the current situation and then fast backward
okay.
some of the precedents, because I'm not sure that I think it's helpful to analogize what's going on here to an international criminal pursuit. In fact, that may be one of the fundamental errors that makes the choice seem so terribly difficult. Mm-hmm. That is, a lot of people seem to think if we don't have the goods, if we don't have the proof that this individual, that Abdullah al-Muhajir or Yasser Assem Hamdi have already committed crimes the way John Walker Lind is accused of having done, if we can't, in effect, try them for what they've already done, we've got to let them go. Now,
your view?
I think we all know that that's not going to happen. No jury confronted with some indication that someone is a member of an organized, even if floating, military force against which the Congress has expressly authorized the President by resolution on September 18th to use all necessary military force, that someone like that is simply going to be allowed to walk the streets. So what will happen in that event, if we insist on putting him on trial in the criminal model, is that we will begin to stretch our concepts of criminal conspiracy to the point where merely thinking of doing something wrong will be criminal. We don't want ultimately to pay the huge price in civil liberties of endorsing a notion like thought crime.
So you'd rather keep it framed as war to avoid polluting a broader area.
That's right. It seems to me that what we have to do is look at how international law and our Constitution have treated the problem of prisoners of war, people taken prisoner, not only caught red-handed on the battlefield, that's the easiest case, but in the case of Gaetano Torito, who was a United States citizen, who was born in the United States, but he grew up in Italy, and he joined Mussolini's army fighting against the United States, or at least that was the allegation. He was captured fleeing from the battlefield. He denied that he was really fighting against the United States. The case came to court when he was brought to California in a military prison. Federal habeas corpus was used to examine whether the government really had strong reason to believe that he was fighting against the U.S., that he was a member of the enemy army, and the district court concluded that there was such evidence and that it was permissible to hold him as a prisoner of war. The point of detaining someone in these circumstances is not to avoid putting him on trial for a crime. He may not have committed a crime. It would violate, in fact, international law to put an ordinary foot soldier who was simply doing the job of the army that he belonged to on trial for a crime. The point is to quarantine, to contain the danger, but we can't simply trust the executive to be telling the truth about the danger. And, of course, the dilemma is some of the evidence that is available to them, some of the evidence that was extracted in conversations from Abu Zubaydah, which is the ultimate source of knowing that Abdullah al-Muhajir is who the government says he is. Some of that evidence is highly sensitive. American informants might die if it were released. We might not be able to detect the next threat to some apartment complex.
Which all suggests that it leaves a gap where the courts and the public are simply going to have to trust the government that they're on the right track.
Well, I think we can narrow the gap rather dramatically. First of all, there are procedures for disclosing information to an independent federal judge under conditions of extraordinary secrecy. The law clerk has to be removed from the chambers as well as the public and the press. The judge can become satisfied that the government has a strong case, that this isn't simply a metaphorical enemies list, that this is indeed strong evidence that someone is a member of al-Qaeda. And the critical point isn't to prove that this fellow was going to build a dirty bomb. We'll never know that for sure. The critical point is to know whether he was an active member, and he seems proudly to be proclaiming, if the report from Philip Shannon is correct, that he was an active member of al-Qaeda. Now, al-Qaeda, as Lewis Gordon says, is not a nation state. But if you look at the constitutional precedents, although they all arose at a time when we were at war with nation states like Germany and Italy, the precedents involving the Nazi saboteurs who were caught not on the field of battle, but infiltrating the United States, abandoning their military uniforms, they were caught, tried, and executed. If you look at those precedents, I think nothing much turns on the fact that the nature of warfare in those days happened to be against organized nation states. We may be entering a new period of history where alternative organizational forms, alternatives to the nation state, as Philip Bobbitt argues in a fascinating new book called The Shield of Achilles, alternative nation state, the alternatives to nation states may be the principal organized forces of terror and of murder against which we have to defend ourselves.
And you're saying the precedent of wartime still applies.
That's right. And wartime doesn't mean all bets are off. It doesn't mean the Constitution is suspended. But it does mean that when those against whom we are warring and those who are making war upon us come into our custody, we don't have to confront the dilemma of cooking up some criminal charge on which we then find them guilty, fearing to release them, and thereby distort our criminal system. On the one hand, or on the other hand, simply letting them go, we have to think about it in terms of the model of quarantining a dangerous individual, dangerous whether he's infected himself with smallpox to spread to the rest of the country, or whether he's simply a dedicated member of a group committed to slaughtering American civilians. But critically, we can't accept simply the president's say-so that someone is a member of such a group.
Lawrence Tribe, Lewis Gordon, please stand by for a second. I've got Nadine Strossen on the line. She's president of the American Civil Liberties Union and professor of law at New York Law School. Good evening and welcome, Nadine Strossen. Thanks for joining us.
Very good to be here.
Nadine Strossen, you've heard Lawrence Tribe taking us through some of the thickets that we've now entered in the war on terror, looking at civil liberties in the United States in the case of Jose Padilla with an American citizen. What do you make of how the government has handled this case so far, and what in your mind are the critical tests going forward of whether or not we're staying within the bounds and spirit of the Constitution?
The strongest point that Professor Tribe made that I wholeheartedly agree with is that we cannot allow this case to proceed merely on the basis of the administration's conclusory characterization of this individual as an enemy combatant. It is absolutely critical that the courts weigh in under our revered system of checks and balances under the Constitution.
Are you confident that's going to happen?
I actually am quite confident for two reasons, Tom. One is that the past cases in which the courts have not done that and, in fact, have simply rubber-stamped assertions that were made by past administrations of the danger posed by, for example, Japanese Americans during World War II, those decisions have been resoundingly repudiated, including by many of the judges who participated. And I think that the courts are very vigilant now not to repeat those past mistakes. The second reason for my confidence, Tom, has to do with lawsuits that the ACLU and other human rights organizations have brought in the wake of the terrorist attacks. And I have been very pleasantly surprised that the courts have stepped forward so far, to the best of my knowledge, without exception in upholding our civil liberties claims and rejecting the administration's claims and the claims of other government officials in some of these cases that there is a, quote, war exception to the First Amendment. They have been very, very strong about demanding actual evidence to justify any deviation from ordinary constitutional procedures.
Nadine Strossen, please stand by. A lot of callers want to join us. Let's get one in. Lauren is on the line. Welcome, Lauren. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to make the point that the Constitution was created for fathers to turn to this time in difficulty. When we have difficult decisions to make, we turn to it so for a point of guidance. So when we know we have a situation such as this, we say, oh, well, in the Bill of Rights and in the Constitution it says this, thus we must go this way. We can't just abandon the Constitution.
And so in our current circumstances, Lauren, what do you think?
Well, I definitely think that, you know, our nation should be protected, and we, you know, if there is there are people out there who are going to attack us, we need to take precautions, but you can't completely eliminate our Constitution, our basis of law, our basis of society. Then you just get anarchy, and that's obviously not where we're going for.
That is the fear. Lauren, thank you for your call. Nadine Strossen, do you fear so far, or do you see so far, that we've crossed a red line? Or are you saying, like Lawrence Tribe, that the test will be whether the courts are brought in to look at the evidence on Jose Padilla, and that's the red line? Or have we already gone past a red line around habeas corpus, let's say?
I am an eternal optimist, and as I say, we're the administration, with the complicity of Congress in some instances, has crossed the line. The courts have been, so far, steadfast in policing the constitutional rights. I think the case that is the closest analogy to the Padilla case is the one involving the material witness, in which Judge Shira Scheinlein in New York said, you cannot use the fear that this person, the unarticulated, unjustified, unsubstantiated, speculative assertion and fear that this individual may engage in future danger to hold him. You simply have to come forward with some evidence, and you cannot use the material witness statute as a way to, in effect, engage in preventive detention. So I would expect a court in the Padilla case to reach essentially the same conclusion, that the fear of danger danger is not going to be, or the unsubstantiated fear of danger is not going to be a justification to subject somebody to indefinite detention through this alternative stratagem of deeming him an enemy combatant. Mm-hmm. And I would also like to note, Tom, that even if this is somebody who can legitimately be deemed a war criminal or suspected war criminal, that does not deprive that person of fundamental human rights under both international human rights law and international humanitarian law, the so-called law of war. He still would be entitled to, you know, basic due process rights, most importantly, the opportunity to consult with a lawyer.
Nadine Strossen, thank you. I know I've got to let you go. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Nadine Strossen is president of the American Civil Liberties Union. Lewis Gordon, I hear you there.
Yeah, I have a question here, which is, when I spoke earlier, I raised the question of whether we're treating terrorism as a unique class of activity. Mm. And the reason I want to raise that is mainly because if we look at, for instance, domestic terrorism, the domestic terrorist sees himself as a soldier, if we look at the McVeigh case, and in many ways...
Oklahoma City.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about if we have individuals, particularly these white supremacist groups, the way they may be conspiring, all kinds of activities related to these. If we're going to work within these categories of terrorists, are we going to... deal with them at the level, for instance, in which we're going to be dealing through the military auspices, or are we facing a certain form of contradiction if we, with mm-hmm. these cases we're suddenly dealing with them in the criminal processes while we're saying this is not criminal, this is dealing with soldiers and so forth?
It's a great question. Lawrence Tribe, what about that? When we have this war on terrorism, as you say, it's not a nation, but it's still a real threat, but the edges become amorphous. Does somehow the war come right into the United States? Right into a case like Timothy McVeigh's case, hypothetically?
No. And the reason is, again, the system of checks and balances. It's not simply the President of the United States who is saying that organizations responsible for September 11th are in a special category. Congress passed a resolution by an overwhelming majority of both houses expressly saying that the President may use, and I'm quoting the language, I have it in front of me, mm-hmm. all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons that the President determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11th, 2001, or harbored such organizations or persons in order to prevent any future acts of international terrorism against the United States.
Well, does that apply to Jose Padilla, who we have no report that he was involved in September 11th?
No, but if the allegations are correct, he is a member of an organization that was itself responsible for September 11, mm-hmm. and Congress has said that that organization is the appropriate target of military force to prevent future attacks of terrorism. It's not necessary that one prove that every member of the enemy army mm-hmm. is a personal threat, and I agree with much of what Nadine Strossen, the president of the ACLU, said, except I do not agree that one can simply extrapolate from Judge Scheinlin's ruling in New York saying that you can't twist the material witness statute as a way of holding someone beyond the statutory deadline.
Lawrence Tribe, please hold that thought, please. We have to take a quick break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Are we on the right track? Join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about civil liberties and the war on terrorism, the case of Jose Padilla and beyond. What do you think? Is the U.S. government striking the right balance of security and civil liberties? Do you trust that you will be protected and not misled? Are you absolutely sure Jose Padilla does not deserve his day in court? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by our guest news analyst tonight, Lewis Gordon, and by Lawrence Tribe, professor of constitutional law at Harvard Law School. And Lawrence Tribe, I'm sorry I had to interrupt you there just before the break.
All
you're
right.
Saying there was one point on which you were not in alignment with Nadine Strossen, president
right.
of the ACLU.
That's right. She said, quite rightly, that the federal statutes that authorize detaining people temporarily as material witnesses for pending criminal cases can't be used to hold someone indefinitely because you think they might pose a danger. And that's why the judge in New York required the release of someone who was being held that way. Now, the current detainee, Abdullah al-Muhajir, mm-hmm. the one about whom there's all this news, was being held in just that status. And when it became clear that the federal courts were not going to tolerate that, the administration, in a move that I think doesn't encourage too much confidence in them, but nonetheless, in a move that might be legal, decided that the real rationale for holding him is that he is a member of an enemy force, the Al-Qaeda, with whom we are essentially at war.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he doesn't have to be a war criminal to be detained on that ground. That is, when Congress has authorized the president to wage military activity against a group that's attacked the U.S. to prevent them from doing it again, every member of that group, whether a U.S. citizen or not, if an active member of a group waging war against this country, can be detained as a war prisoner, not on the basis of some prediction that person is bound to be dangerous, and not on the basis of punishing the person for a thought crime, but simply because no nation that is not suicidal in its tendencies simply captures people waging war against it and then lets them go to see what will happen. But the key point, and this is the important point on which I certainly agree with Nadine Strossen and the ACLU, is that we cannot invite the kind of tyrannical abuse that might occur if a president, perhaps less genial than the current occupant of the White House,
perhaps
more paranoid, more taken to having McCarthy-like enemies lists, begins sweeping people off the streets and saying that they are metaphorically part of some enemy, that they're enemies of the Republic. That we can't do, and that's why we have to have, whatever the president may say and whatever the Secretary of Defense may say, we've got to have a federal court look at the evidence in closed court if necessary, not necessarily second-guessing the military,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily looking at it through a microscope, but at least demanding solid proof that the person is what they say he is.
Lawrence Tribe, Lewis Gordon, please stand by. We've got a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. Let's turn to them. Jalel is on the line. Welcome, Jalel. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. My comment relates to your guest's point. He said that the Congress has given the president authority to use whatever means necessary to go after those who are involved in September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that if the allegations are true about Joseph Padilla, then he can be an extrapolation of that, is that he can be held indefinitely as an unlawful combatant. My comment is that how is that ever to be determined if he is, in fact, if those allegations, in fact, are true, that he is a member of an organization, an active member who was planning these events, unless there is some legal process that determines it.
Well, Lawrence Tribe is saying, put it before a court, put it before a judge. Does that satisfy you, Jalel?
That is exactly what I think has to happen. Even if those proceedings are closed, I think they ought to be open so that we as a society do not, you know, head towards circumventing the system. But I firmly agree that it has to go through some legal process. You cannot just indefinitely hold. And Rumsfeld's comment that we're not interested in punishing him, we're not interested in trying him, we just want to hold him. And I think that's just heading down a slippery path, which is very, very easy to abuse.
Jalel, thank you for your call. And Lawrence Tribe, how about that? I read that typically, of course, a prisoner of war would be held until the end of the war. But we are told that this may be a war without clear end. What does that mean for someone like Jose Padilla or Abdullah al-Muhajir, as he calls himself?
It may mean that his detention is going to last a very long time, but only if a court concludes that the evidence that he is an active member of a group waging war against the country is solid evidence. It's not a pleasant prospect, certainly, but then this kind of terrorism, which may last for years, is hardly pleasant. Your caller made the point that the matter has to be put to a judge. That I agree. I also agree with the caller, Jalel, that when the Secretary of Defense says, we don't want to punish him, we just want to squeeze information out of him, he's kind of going down the wrong track. Those aren't the choices. It's not punishing versus interrogating indefinitely. The choices are releasing him if the government that does not have objective reason to think he's a member of Al-Qaeda and an active member, or holding him subject to all of the protections of human rights and the Geneva Convention to which prisoners of war are entitled, unless the further proof is advanced and the judge accepts it, that he's not only an enemy combatant, but an unlawful belligerent. You notice the government hasn't yet called him that. That is, being an unlawful belligerent, which is the category that the U.S. Supreme Court used when it talked about the Nazi saboteurs who landed in Long Island and on the coast of Florida. Being an unlawful belligerent means you don't even have the rights of a prisoner of war. It means that
You didn't wear the uniform, you're not playing by the rules, and so we don't have to extend those rights to you.
Certainly not all of the rights. Mm-hmm. The right, however, to due process, to have some kind of airing before a court of your side of the case with a lawyer, that right extends.
Lawrence Trump, I must say I hope you're right, but I'm not sure I get the vibe from this administration, Rumsfeld, Ashcroft, and others, that they're necessarily going to be as focused on that day in court or that judge's review of this case as you feel confident that they will.
No, please make no mistake. Mm-hmm. I don't have enormous confidence in their fidelity to the day in court principle. It's the courts that I'm looking to, and I'm not absolutely sure that they won't let us down. But the history indicates, certainly so far in this episode, that courts have not gone down the path of simply deferring blindly to the executive. I think the administration's feet have to be held to the fire on this one.
There's a lot on the line. Carolyn is calling. Welcome, Carolyn. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I want to comment about the comparison with the Japanese who were interned.
They during
were
World War II.
Mm-hmm. There was no evidence whatsoever against any of those people that they had done any harm or joined any enemy of our country. So their internment, is justifiably criticized. But this man has got a criminal history.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of evidence by the security divisions that he is a member of the enemies of our country, and so he should be considered a traitor. So why are we so worried about him and wanting to treat him with kid gloves? I do not understand.
Well, Carolyn, let me just ask you, as a fellow citizen of Jose Padilla, are you prepared to just take the government's word for it, or do you agree with Lawrence Tribe that ought to look at this and examine?
There's plenty of investigators that have been following this man for ages, according to the reports in the papers. What do you mean by the government?
Well, in the same way that when a prosecutor brings a case against a criminal, we ask them to show some evidence. Without some evidence being shown to a court, are you prepared to just say, FBI, CIA, if you say so, that's fine by me?
Well, I think when you're in a state of war like we are, you have to suspend some of these normal activities of going through the courts. I mean, if these investigative agencies that we rely on for our protection are claiming that this man is a dangerous man to our country, I think we should listen to them.
Carolyn, thank you for your call. Lewis Gordon, there you hear a readiness under the threat that is widely felt of acute danger to put down that judicial intervention, to set it aside.
The key terms that were used by the caller, though, was a state of war. And in many ways, we were having discussion in terms of how we fine-tune the categories here. One of the things that is very important that emerged is that we've been using this term war on terror, but specifically speaking, this is a war on al-Qaeda. And once we make it very clear that that's what we're dealing with, then the question of membership, those who are part of that group are part of a group that's in this hostile relationship with us, which basically changes a lot of the terms we use in the more vague, abstract war and terror everywhere.
But Lawrence Tribe, we just got half a minute left. This term war has been very elastic in the last 9 months and continues to be used in a very elastic way by the administration.
Well, but it's not the term war that I'm relying on. It's the fact that Congress said we have the right to go against this group. The caller said that we rely on these intelligence agencies to protect us. They didn't do all that great a job on September 11th. And earlier, at the beginning of your program, you had a New York Times fellow say that if we tried as hard to penetrate al-Qaeda with our own citizens who masquerade as their members, as now the FBI and the CIA want to try to penetrate ordinary civilian groups.
He said all they needed was a passport to get in, and we didn't do it. Lawrence Tribe, Lewis Gordon, we're out of time. Lawrence Tribe, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Lawrence Tribe is professor of constitutional law at Harvard Law School. And Lewis Gordon, thank you for being with us this hour.
No, it's my pleasure.
You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a suburban mom prepares for a possible terrorist attack on the nuclear power plant in the town next door. This is On Point. About a decade ago, Maureen Stark and her husband moved to Yorktown Heights in Westchester County, just north of New York City. They bought a house, they had children, and they didn't think much about the Indian Point nuclear power plant nearby. But September 11th changed all that. The threat of a terrorist attack on the facility has brought the risk of a catastrophic event to the forefront for her and many of her neighbors. In this diary, she talks about living with the risk and about an answering machine message from her county commissioner letting her family know that they were entitled to free doses of potassium iodide to protect them from radiation poisoning.
In the unlikely event of a nuclear emergency, we are offering you and your family KI pills at these distribution sites. And they went ahead and listed three sites that would be probably 10 miles apart. To have a medicine cabinet full of now what I have is KI seems ridiculous to me, simply because it's one type of cancer, a thyroid cancer that could be caused by a certain type of radiation release, and people are thinking that this is good. They're calling it the radiation pill, and that they can take this pill and they're going to be fine. I know that's not the case, and certainly if the worst case scenario happened, I would have no choice but to use it. However, my husband's allergic to iodide and cannot use it, so anybody who has a shellfish allergy has really gotten a raw end of the deal here. It's not a nice scenario, whatever way you look at it. I don't see an immediate cessation to my stress level, that's for sure. My perception is different than a lot of people's perception. I would say maybe 50% of the people believe that the plant will explode as a Hiroshima-type explosion and that they don't have to do anything simply because they will be obliterated in one eye blink. That is not true from my reading and my attending one meeting. That it would be a low-level to a moderate-level radiation leak that would cause a serious exposure to radiation, which would result in death that could take anywhere from weeks to months, which would be slow and painful. That's a little bit different than just having an explosion. I'm not a paranoid person, neither are my children. I try and downplay the seriousness of it in front of them. I don't think it's something they need to worry about on a day-to-day basis since they cannot really do anything about it. I think it's up to the adults to protect the children, and that's my role as a mother. And I will do whatever it takes to protect my children. There was a plan in place that would have bus students out to some point unknown. There was some problem with getting bus drivers up here. There's also the issue of would there be enough buses to transport. In that midst of confusion, what I told my two older children was that they are to leave the school at any point. They have a note in their backpack that is signed by me, and that they are to meet at a specified location, which is approximately a block from the school. There are days when I wish we could go back to just having Indian Point there and it, you know, not being a big problem for anybody, but that's not reality. And I know people are relocating, but there's not too many other plans I have right now. We are not going to relocate. So you own a home, you have three children in school, and you try and live each day as if things were going to work out for the best.
Maureen Stark lives with her family in Yorktown Heights, New York. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMayo, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Laura Tanguso, Samantha Sodikson, Stephen Belter, and Chris Bonacci. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.